From WBUR Boston, this is Here and Now, a daily digest of news and culture.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, what happened when Sunnis and Shias met secretly in Finland recently? We'll have a conversation with the professor who brought them together. But first, the picket lines are up and a nationwide autoworker strike is underway against General Motors after bargainers for the UAW and GM failed to reach agreement on a new contract. UAW President Ron Gettelfinger says his negotiating team did everything it could to avoid a strike.
A company walked right up to the deadline like they really didn't care. And as a result of that, we called a strike at 11 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time this morning.
Mickey Maynard has been watching the ebb and flow of the talks for the New York Times. She joins us now. Mickey, are there any talks at all going on?
Robin, the talks broke off shortly after the 11 o'clock deadline passed, but I wouldn't be surprised if people at levels of the company and the union are speaking with each other.
Well, over the weekend, reports seem to indicate that a contract settlement between the union and General Motors was well at hand. What happened?
Well, actually, the Times had never reported that because this is a very complicated set of talks. There are two major issues here. On the union side, it's the issue of job security. On the GM side, it's the issue of this big health care trust where they want to move their liability for worker and retiree health care. And both of them depend on each other, and you can't get one without the other. The UAW won't agree to the trust, and GM won't grant what the union's looking for unless it gets the trust.
Well, tell us a little more about this trust. I mean, U.S. automakers have been saying for years that they need some relief from their health care costs to close an approximately $25 per hour labor gap with their competitors in Asian countries. GM and the UAW have been negotiating this proposal, as you said, would shift retirement health care costs from the company to the union. So tell us more about that trust.
Well, the trust is called a VEBA, and these are in place at a number of companies. And what happens is the liability for health care comes off the company's books and it goes into a trust fund. And it's funded anywhere between 50 to 70% of the estimated value of the liability over time. So it's funded at a discount, and it's to the union's advantage to have it funded either in cash or if the stock is worth something in stock, but the UAW has been pushing for mostly cash. Now, what happens is that comes off the company's books, and so in theory, its credit rating from the companies like S&P, Standard & Poor's in New York, could go up. General Motors and Ford are deep into junk ratings, and that raises their cost of borrowing. So it's a terrific financial benefit to the companies who can get VEBA, but it does shift the risk to the union and to the administrators of the trust.
And just to have, so I've heard you clearly, initially it makes it look as if the company that's shifting the money is less prosperous.
Well, no, it actually makes them look as if they have less debt.
Yeah.
Because this is viewed as a debt in terms of the financial community. So it makes them look more prosperous.
Ah, I see. Okay. Well, the UAW strike fund stands at about $900 million. That's enough to sustain members for several months. General Motors has 80 manufacturing facilities. So give us a sense of, I mean, it's early, very early on.
Right. But I covered the strike in 1998 in Flint, and that was actually two plants that made parts, and they knocked out the rest of the GM system. That went on for 7 weeks. I mean, when the two sides get dug in, they can stare at each other for a long time. You know, the sense had been that there wouldn't be a strike at all, and I think people are saying, oh, well, there'll be a short strike so that people can blow off steam and raise picket signs, and then everybody will get back to work. But, you know, there is no way to predict this. It is a very tenuous situation.
Well, and next up for the UAW, negotiations with Ford and Chrysler.
Well, they have to. They can do it one of two ways. They can try to finish at GM and go over to one of those companies next, or they could go to one of those companies while the GM situation is underway. Whoever goes next is actually in a better position than who goes last, because the last company would be under the most pressure to follow what's called a pattern settlement.
And in the meantime, how does this affect everyone else? You know, people who aren't working for the auto industry. How does it impact the rest of us?
Well, the interesting thing is this comes as the Detroit companies have the smallest market share in their history. They have a little bit under 50% of the American market, and Asian and foreign manufacturers actually have more of the American market. So it's just slightly, by a very slight margin, Americans have said, you know, we aren't buying your cars anyway. So in a sense, it hurts GM's image as much as anything, because people will wait until the strike is over to buy a vehicle so they can be sure that that it's being built by people who are glad to have their jobs.
And it's going to be delivered. Mickey Maynard follows the auto industry for the New York Times. Mickey, thanks as always.
It's my pleasure, Robin.
Question, can Iraq's feuding Sunnis and Shiites learn any lessons from South Africa and Northern Ireland? Well, our next guest says yes, and he's trying to make it happen. Purig O'Malley was behind that secret meeting of Sunnis and Shiites earlier this month in Finland. They left the gathering with a document called the Helsinki Agreement, which could serve as a roadmap to peace in Iraq. To get them to Finland, O'Malley spent 5 weeks in Iraq, eating stale bread, living in threadbare hotels without electricity, trying to find the teams of Sunnis and Shiites who would travel to Helsinki. And a former student of O'Malley's donated the money, thousands of dollars in cash, to pay for the plane tickets. O'Malley is the go-to guy for these kinds of sessions, having engineered a meeting between rival factions in Northern Ireland 15 years ago and another between bitter enemies in South Africa in 1997. Purig O'Malley is a professor at the McCormick Graduate School of Policy Studies at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. And he joins us now to tell us, you know, what happened, the story behind the headlines. Purig, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And I should say welcome back, because you brought a guest to us a while back. And we're understanding now that that guest from Iraq coming to Boston for a meeting at Tufts University was sort of the beginning of all of this. Tell us about that.
Well, at that conference at Tufts University, we had invited people from South Africa and from Northern Ireland, with the explicit idea that if there was a good interaction between the Iraqis and the Northern Irish and the South Africans, that the possibility existed of taking this whole thing one step further. By that I mean, I would say a lot of my own work has been grounded in the belief that the best people to help others in a divided society are people from other divided societies.
In fact, you make a comparison to, you know, self-help groups in other areas, you know, people who are, you know, maybe even addicted.
That would be a very good analogy. They share certain behavioral characteristics. They tend to act and react to certain events in a certain way. They all think their conflicts are unique, that nobody can really understand them except themselves. They have a certain way in which they form perceptions and counter-perceptions. So putting them together, you will find when somebody from one group is talking, somebody from another group is nodding his head. Mm. He's identifying with what the person is saying. So the broad idea was that perhaps here we had an opportunity to take people in Iraq, particularly from the Sunni and Shia sects, to put them together with a group of the key negotiators who had negotiated the settlement in South Africa in 1994, the key negotiators who had effected the settlement in Northern Ireland that finally came to full fruition just in May of this year. And we also made an effort that in the end, you must bring the people of violence, the insurgents, the terrorists, whatever you want to call them, you must bring them to the table, that you cannot have a political settlement that excludes certain factions, especially the factions that deal in violence.
When you have groups like this together, I'm wondering, you say that they nod at each other and they start recognizing that they have similarities in their own stories. But there, is there also a moment where they each try to say, no, 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 yours couldn't be like mine. I have hundreds of years of history. Do they compete at all?
In fact, that didn't happen.
Huh.
The Iraqis had more of a fascination with Northern Ireland than South Africa, in part because the settlement in Northern Ireland has been so recent, in part because many of them had spent their exile in the United Kingdom, so were very familiar with the Northern Ireland, and meant they were familiar with Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness. And when they saw Martin McGuinness and Geoffrey Donaldson, two men who had been intense antagonists for 20, 30 years, making a joint presentation and calling each other by their first name, it was awesome. Hmm. They were looking at men who had been avowed enemies, who had found a way to negotiate their way out of violence into a situation where they could agree on a power-sharing government.
What did they say? What did Martin McGuinness, for instance, say about how you do that?
Well, the first thing is that you have to bring your own constituency with you, and that the IRA, for example, Sinn Féin could never have taken the steps it took unless it had spent a number of years educating its own constituency to the point of understanding that they were never going to achieve their objectives by the use of physical force. But the difference between the IRA and the insurgency, former members of Saddam's party, is that the IRA had a political voice in Sinn Féin that could always articulate its demands and that was always there to negotiate with, whereas the insurgencies in Iraq have not yet gotten to the point of having a political voice. So until the mainstream political parties reach out to them to say, in the end, this violence can't go on forever. You'll go down to the last two men standing and we say, now do we kill each other or do we talk to each other? And one of the things that both the Northern Irish and the South Africans spent quite an amount of time on was going through the mistakes they had made on the path to get it right. And they were saying to the Iraqis that the Iraqis didn't need to go through the same litany of mistakes to get to a point where they understood that only an all-inclusive negotiating process was the way to work. Now, what emerged from that then, they agreed to the Helsinki Agreement. Now, the basis for that 12-point agreement was in the course of making their presentation, either McGuinness or Donaldson handed out what were referred to in Northern Ireland as the Mitchell Principles. These were the principles drawn up among the parties when Senator George Mitchell was overseeing the negotiating process in Northern Ireland. And the first thing he did was to try to get the parties together to agree on a set of rules that would be the framework within which negotiations would be conducted.
I have the Helsinki Agreement in front of me. Number one, to resolve all political issues through nonviolence and democracy. Two, to prohibit the use of arms for all armed groups during the process of negotiations. And then also, number 10, to establish an independent consultative body to explore ways to deal with the legacy of the past in a way that will unite the nation. So it calls for a reconciliation.
It calls for, in the end, when the time is right, some kind of a commission that would, as countries that go through horrific conflict will have to look at the past and examine it in some way before any kind of a healing process can take place.
Well, today, Iraqis, of course, a long way from that healing process, but our guest, Padraig O'Malley, has seen it happen in South Africa and Northern Ireland. If you just joined us, again, earlier this month, representatives from those countries, Northern Ireland and South Africa, shared their experiences with Sunnis and Shiites in a meeting in Finland that Padraig helped organize. I want to ask you about something that apparently happened at the beginning of the meeting, because it helps us understand how the Sunnis and Shiites view themselves. Tell us about that.
When we had asked the parties to break out to a Shia bloc and a Sunni bloc, there was immediate resistance. They were Iraqis, not Shia or Sunni.
We found this when you've brought Iraqi guests on the program, and I made, I guess, the mistake of asking casually, are you Sunni or Shia? And he found it incredibly insulting. And yet we understood that this is exactly how Iraqis look at each other, as Sunni and Shia. But you say they've got this sort of dual thinking about it. On the one hand, they think that that's a Western device.
Concoction to create division and give an easy explanation to the complexity of events taking place in Iraq.
But is it? I mean, you said to me that you would speak to someone, some minister or something, and he would say, no, there's no divide. That's just a Western concoction. And then in the outer room, the secretary would tell you what? That she had a move.
She got a notice. The notice under her door was that you have 24 hours to be out of here. And the notice was from the bodyguard of a Sunni politician whom she passed in Parliament.
Huh. As opposed to Northern Ireland, where people are very clear, they're Catholic or they're Protestant, and that's at the basis of the conflict. But
No, in Northern Ireland, they wouldn't say that. And in Northern Ireland, to put it in terms of Catholic and Protestants to the protagonists on both sides would be insulting to them.
Would it?
Yeah. They would say, no. We are Protestants, but we want to remain part of Britain, of the UK. Yeah. And to Catholic nationalists would say, yeah, we are Catholic, but that's incidental. The important thing is that we want to be part of a united Ireland. At the same time, there was a religious element to the conflict, and in the same way in Iraq, Sunnis for centuries always had power, and overnight they lost it. Whereas if you look at, compare them with the whites of South Africa, they had all the power, but they knew the day was coming when they were going to lose that power. That had never entered into the mind of a Sunni politician.
Did they start to see how they had these parallel stories to white South Africans in the case you just gave, or Catholics and Protestants who think of themselves more as, you know, nationalists or mm-hmm. wanting to identify with Britain? Did they start to see how their stories were similar?
Well, yes, they began to see it in terms of majorities and minorities. Either a minority had exercised all power, and now you had a situation where possibly a majority was going to exercise all power. So the question is, how do you reach an agreement where power is shared between minority and a majority so as to bring about stability and end the armed uprising by either the majority or the minority? The big complaint of the Sunnis is that Shias, having obtained power, want to hold it all to themselves. And in part that is because the Shias deep down believe, having been repressed not just under Saddam, but throughout their history, that the remnants of the Ba'athist party were still powerful enough to seize all power back, and that if they begin to give some power back to the Sunnis would use it in a way so as to gain all power. At the same time, the Sunni have got to understand they are a minority, and while minorities have rights, that there are limits on how much power a minority can demand.
What do you think? Do you have hope, Portig O'Malley, that this...
Well, I hope to go back there late October, beginning of November, and make a report, as I promised, to the two vice presidents. There was talk by the Minister of National Reconciliation, who did attend, in setting up a small secretariat to see how further meetings could be worked out. But we are not soliciting them. Hmm. They're not saying, this worked so well, you've got to go to the next step. We're saying very deliberately, step one is over, the ball is in your court.
Well, Portig O'Malley, you've worked in Johannesburg working on these issues. You were raised in Dublin. You know, I guess the other question is, how much do these agreements matter in the long run? Of course, we look at Northern Ireland. Some can't believe it. They see it as a miracle. The same with South Africa. And yet, you wrote in the Boston Globe just a few months ago that Northern Ireland is now more divided than ever.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of criticism of South Africa, the government mm-hmm. there, the AIDS on the, you know, rampant. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to ask you if it's worth it, because obviously it's worth it to have killing and violence stop, but it's not perfect, I guess.
No, but I'd make a distinction between two things. And again, the addiction analogy is a good one, that people in divided societies can reach to a peaceful settlement, i.e. where there is no more violence, where the institutions of governance are slowly being built up, or the rule of law is being adhered to. But the question of the healing of the society is a separate process. It's like one in recovery. And if it doesn't nurture its own recovery, if it forgets its own recent past and the extraordinary violence and horrific acts of cruelty and torture that existed, then slowly it will disintegrate back into that situation. In Northern Ireland, Catholics and Protestants are more likely to end up living in their separate enclaves than they were 20 or 30 years ago. Within Iraq, there's like over 1 million internally displaced people, never mind the 2 million who have left the country. And there's a huge problem with regard to location and where people will be. So, no, I agree with you on the point you made. Do efforts like this matter? And my honest answer is I haven't a clue. The point is you do them, and you do them without expectations, because in the end, Iraqis must solve their own problem.
Portugal Malley holds the Joe Moakley Chair of Peace and Reconciliation at the McCormick Graduate School of Policy Studies at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. By the way, the late Joe Moakley was the congressman from Massachusetts. He died in 2001, who was credited with opening the way to the eventual peaceful settlement between rebels and the Salvadoran government after he investigated the murders of Jesuit priests by a military death squad in El Salvador. We want to mention Joe Moakley whenever we can as well. Portugal Malley, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Officials in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, issued a warning today asking the Buddhist clergy to restrain protesting monks, saying that if they didn't, the government would have to act. The exiled Tibetan Buddhist leader, the Dalai Lama, asked officials not to crack down. What began as a series of scattered protests last month has grown into the largest demonstration against the Burmese military regime in nearly 20 years. More than 10,000 young Buddhist monks marched yesterday and today in quiet protest against the regime, surrounded by tens of thousands of ordinary citizens who held hands and formed a human chain to protect the monks. Thant Nhien Tu is author of River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. He joins us now. Thant, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is said to be the largest set of demonstrations against the military regime in Myanmar since 1988. Remind us, what happened then?
In some ways, it was very similar. It was a series of protests which snowballed over a few months' time and led to a huge uprising involving hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps millions of people, in many different cities and towns in the country in August and September of 1988. And that led first to the army withdrawing and people actually taking over many places around the country, but then the army eventually cracking down, killing perhaps as many as 3,000 people in mid-September 88 and restoring military rule.
We understand the dictator was toppled and his military officials were toppled, but a new crop of generals took over.
Yes, General Ne Win had first taken over as head of the army. He took over the government in 1962. So in some ways, this present military government is only the latest incarnation of a series of military governments. In 1988, General Ne Win stepped back from power, but then he appointed his protégés to take over as the new ruling junta, more or less the same junta that's carried on to this day.
Well, then elections were held in 1990, but then what happened?
When the government cracked down in September of 1988, they promised that this was only going to be temporary military rule and it would lead eventually to an elected civilian government. And so in 1990, contrary to many people's expectations, they actually held free and fair elections. And that was won overwhelmingly by the National League for Democracy, which was led by Aung San Suu Kyi. But the military, either because they were surprised by the victory of this opposition party or for other reasons, decided in the end that they wouldn't hand over power. And so the last 15, 20 years almost has been, in a way, a political stalemate between these two opposing sides, the Democrats led by Aung San Suu Kyi and the army government, who, despite their earlier promises, have not given up power.
And Aung San Suu Kyi, we know, has been in and out of house arrest since then. She also won the Nobel Prize. These current protests began in August over what would seem to be relatively simple, a sharp rise in fuel prices. How did it go from a protest against prices to what seems today like a challenge to the government?
Well, I mean, in many ways, you know, the economy has had many ups and downs. In general, the economy has done very, very badly since the army took over in 1962, certainly compared to many of its neighbors over the past 10, 15 years, like China, Vietnam, Thailand, not to mention Malaysia or Singapore. And so there's been a lot of discontent, not just against the government's political policies, but also against its economic policies. Things got better in some ways in the 1990s, but then the sanctions were imposed by many Western countries. The government's own bad policies led to worsening economic conditions. And I think things went from sort of bad to worse over the last few years. And the government's decision to cut fuel subsidies, which tripled or quadrupled the price of gas and transport and bus prices and train prices and things, was in a way just a straw that broke the camel's back. And many people who I think had already been very upset with economic conditions and worsening economic conditions decided that they would brave the streets and resort to public protest.
Well, and take us outside of Myanmar, formerly Burma, to the area around it. How are the neighboring countries, you know, participating or somehow, you know, also a part of this story? China, for instance, a large factor in Burmese politics, said to be maybe even a restraining factor right now. Tell us China's role.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to understand that Burma is a country which has been at civil war in a certain way since independence from Britain, or even just before independence from Britain in 1948. It's the Burmese army came to power in part because it was battling a whole variety of different ethnic insurgencies and communist insurgencies. In the late 1980s, the Communist Party of Burma, the communist insurgency, basically collapsed, and that opened the door to much better relations between China, which had been backing the communists, and the Burmese army, which had been fighting the communists for decades. And that relationship, which sort of took off when Western sanctions were imposed and the West sort of distanced themselves from this military junta, and has gone from strength to strength. And I think it's been very much helped by the fact that Burma has, over the last 5, 6, 7 years, found that it's sitting on top of one of the biggest natural gas fields in the world. And China and India are both, as we know, hungry for new energy resources. And so China has been courting the Burmese generals partly for access to these energy resources, partly because it's the neighbor next door that it wants to make sure it has a good relationship with, and partly because this Burmese government has largely ended the fighting that had been going on for many decades. I think what the Chinese are worried about is whether or not this government can actually provide stability at a time when the Chinese government wants stability in Burma, wants access to Burma's natural gas, wants a neighbor that it can rely on to do business with, to trade, and other things.
And wants it to look and wants it to be nice and tidy by the Beijing Olympics.
I think the Chinese don't want this to be a Darfur or Zimbabwe, a country which is going to embarrass them internationally. In the region, there's also India. And India is the country that's most worried, perhaps, about growing Chinese influence in Burma. So Burma, the Burmese government, finds itself in actually the very enviable position of being courted by these two huge Asian giants. And it's been somewhat skillful in the past 10 years in playing off one against the other.
Well, Thantmien Tu, you're in Bangkok now, but you are Burmese. You have deep roots in Burma, Myanmar. Your grandfather was Secretary General of the UN. You've become a scholar of Burma. First of all, just briefly in the time we have, but your sense of these thousands of Buddhist monks marching, protected by civilians, how is that image resonating?
I think that when you go to Burma, you realize that first and foremost, it's a deeply Buddhist society. And so for the 85% of Burmese people who are Buddhist, the monasteries, the Buddhist monks have an incredibly important role in day-to-day life, in village life, town life, city life. And so for the monks to actually take to the streets in this way is something which is has deep resonance, I think, amongst pretty much all Burmese people, and it will be very difficult, though they've done it before, it would be very difficult for the government to crack down on demonstrations that are led by Buddhist monks.
But as we said today, they're warning the clerical leaders that they will have to crack down. What do you see happening?
Well, I think there's still a small window, over the next couple of days when this could all still be resolved peacefully. But this is an army government that has placed a priority on preventing an uprising like in 1988 from getting out of hand. So I think whatever they do, it'll be some sort of crackdown. One hopes that if there is going to be a crackdown, it's going to be relatively bloodless. There could be differences of opinion within the military regime itself. My fear is that some sort of crackdown over the next few days is the most likely scenario.
Thantmien Tu, author of River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. Thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Okay, remember the time your boss made everyone do calisthenics? Or when you all had to wear those funny hats to loosen up? Or the time that Michael made everyone get on a bus and go to the beach? Oh, wait, that was actor Steve Carell, the boss on the hit NBC show The Office. His lone African-American employee was not amused.
Everybody, may I have your attention, please? Today, we are not just spending a day at the beach.
Oh, sweet mother of God.
If you don't like it, Stanley, you can go to the back of the bus.
Excuse me?
Or the front of the bus, or drive the bus. We are all participating in mandatory fun activities. Funtivities!
Funtivities! For the characters on The Office, they've included a party on a ferry in dead winter, sumo suit wrestling, where one of the office workers tips like a beach ball into the water and floats away. But maybe the show is onto something. According to a conference board study, only half of Americans are satisfied with their jobs, and so many companies are trying to cheer things up by hiring fun consultants. Could hallway golf and paper airplane contests be coming to a cubicle near you? Martin Kine is a business and entertainment writer and author of House of Lies, How Management Consultants Steal Your Watch and Then Tell You the Time. He joins us. And Marty, does the popularity of The Office tell us something about how Americans view forced fun?
Yeah, I think The Office is actually a stunningly realistic view of what actual offices are like as opposed to the sitcom offices of Mary Tyler Moore days. That boss and his forced hilarity is a very good window into an office.
Oh, they hate it. They just hate it. You know, he's supposedly doing this for them, but he doesn't seem to care that they hate it. You know, why are other companies doing it if, in fact, you know, it can go so wrong?
I mean, there's a couple of reasons here. Fun salting, actually, people may not remember, but it was big last time in about 97, 98, right a year or two before the dot-com bubble burst. There were rumors about dot-com companies where you could bring your dog to work. You know, there were basketball hoops in the office. And that went away 2001, 2002. Now the times are a little bit better, and the dot-com companies have made a comeback. The fun envy factor has come back into play.
Let's list some of the consultants that exist. There's Fun Salting, etc., Funcilitators, they have those laughter clubs where they just make people laugh and you're supposed to feel better. The fun department in Delaware has, among other things, grass skirts and hula hoops. Do you think any of it works?
It's hard to say. Of course it's fun, and it's fun because you're out of the office. The main purpose of all these consulting activities is to put people in an environment where they're not seeing their coworkers in the office hierarchy. So they're in a flatter environment where they're seeing each other as human beings. And any activity that accomplishes that is a good thing, I would say. The bad thing is, though, if offices think that by hiring fun consultants, they've actually done their duty toward fun, and then they can go back to business as usual.
Some people might say, well, if you really want to boost morale, reduce tension, give your employees a break, give them an extra vacation day.
Or, you know, give them a gift certificate or something. Because fun salting, ultimately, even though it can be fun at the time, I know from experience, when it's over, there's a little bit of a letdown. So then when you go back to the office, it seems a little bit worse by comparison. And in fact, it can get counterproductive. I had an experience recently. I had a meeting with a big client, and they had hired a fun salting who decided that they needed to loosen up in their communication. So they actually had a rubber chicken that sat in a chair. And I got, what's this rubber chicken? They said, well, we need to include the rubber chicken in the conversation. So I'm not kidding. These are like VPs of a major financial services company who are asking questions of this rubber chicken, and then other employees there would answer in a funny voice. And it did loosen things up, but, you know, the chicken became the star of the meeting, and we didn't get anything done. A very common one, probably because it's a little cheaper, is companies set aside rooms that are more like fun rooms. So even after the consultants leave, they'll leave these rooms that have balls in them and hula hoops and Etch-a-Sketches. So it's very much like going back to second childhood. But I've never actually seen that people who go into those rooms actually come up with more creative ideas. What they end up doing is just playing with the hula hoop.
So all in all, Marty, again, a former consultant, then you wrote a book really tearing consultants apart. Are you now a consultant on anti-consultancy?
Yes, absolutely. If a company wants to hire me to talk about how they shouldn't hire consultants, that's exactly what I do. It's a very important service that I'm providing, and I'm living proof that there is a consultant for everything.
Marty Kine, business and entertainment writer, author of House of Lies, How Management Consultants Steal Your Watch and Then Tell You the Time. Marty, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jack Kerouac's On the Road captivated a restless post-war generation when it was originally published 50 years ago. The book launched countless cross-country treks and also took the author out of what was then a fading factory town, Lowell, Massachusetts, and made him a star. Earlier this summer, Boston Globe reporter Charles Sennett made his own journey across the U.S. to retrace the path of the novel's main character, Sal Paradise. We're going to talk with Charlie Sennett in a moment, but first, let's hear his diary from the road.
Hi, folks. Good morning from the flight. Our connection going to Des Moines, Iowa.
All right, so we're cheating a little bit, but, you know, so did Kerouac. He took a bus halfway across the country.
In Kerouac's novel, his central character, Sal Paradise, starts off frustrated with the slow process of hitchhiking in upstate New York. So in Chapter 3, he hops a bus to Chicago to jumpstart the trip. I started in Des Moines at the Avis car rental desk.
Ooh, you're doing some serious driving.
In the evening, ain't we got fun? Sweet little baby, ain't we got fun?
With a CD of Kerouac singing Ain't We Got Fun, I got on the road. Just a few miles from the airport, I was passing the same train yards where Kerouac stayed, in a dingy hotel that no longer exists. I pulled to a stop on Locust Street. Maybe it was just luck, but right away I met up with a guy who not only knew the book, but could quote dialogue.
Sal, we gotta go and never stop till we get there. Where are we gonna go, man? I don't know, but we gotta go. And that's the mission statement of my company. We're not sure where we're going, but that's where we're going to go.
Chip Eagle is 48 years old and the publisher of a blues magazine. I found him sitting in the Continental Cafe. He was wearing dark Ray-Bans and a Hawaiian shirt, sipping red wine in the afternoon and talking about Kerouac.
You know, gradually you get to page 28 and it says, most beautiful girls in the world are in Des Moines, Iowa. This is the place. And, you know, just the fact that my hometown, which isn't certainly the center of beat culture or music or God knows anything but corn and soybeans and pigs, becomes important in something that's a manifesto of a generation, my generation too.
The review of On the Road in the New York Times in 1957 said with great prescience that the book would define a new generation, the beat generation. It's a generation that does not know what it is searching for, but it is searching, the reviewer wrote. A generation that expects the imminence of war and the barrenness of politics. Chip Eagle says things aren't so different today.
Kids today, when they're, you know, searching, you know, what teenage person doesn't search and look and try to find passion in what's going on? And the book is about passion and about living the moment. You know, between Sal and Dean, there's a lot of meaning and a lot of life.
This raw depth of feeling about Kerouac came in a flood within the first half hour of arriving in Des Moines and within the space of one block. The timelessness of Kerouac was here. And in Des Moines, with that thought in mind, I looked out across the street and saw the campaign headquarters for Barack Obama. And I thought I'd walk in and see if young volunteers had ever heard of the book or if they felt it spoke to their generation.
My name's Brian Van Riper from Pembroke, Massachusetts. I'm 26 years old. I read Kerouac in 2001.
Brian told me he first read On the Road when he was stationed with the Marine Corps at Guantanamo Bay on the heels of September 11th. The book was searing for him, he said, and it launched him after his tour of duty on a cross-country journey to California.
It means to me a sense of freedom, the ability to do what you want to do. When you want to do it, and making your own rules in life.
Brian seemed the perfect person to ask about whether his generation, like the Beats before, saw politics as barren and war as imminent.
People thought nuclear annihilation was around the bend in the late 50s. Today, I mean, terrorism could happen at any chance. It's a continued theme.
And Brian said that many of his generation share a fatigue and apathy reminiscent of the 1950s.
I've seen a lot of my peers get tired. I just see the look in their eye. They didn't necessarily dare to dream. Then there was a whole separate generation that existed in the late 50s with Kerouac that just kind of wanted to go out and just see what else was out there. And I think I fell into that, definitely.
I left Des Moines and headed out on Route 80 West and tried to make it to Lincoln, Nebraska by nightfall. I did. And I pulled up in front of a great blues and country music bar. With the salty smell of pulled pork in the air and a warm breeze blowing in from the street, I ordered a cold beer across the red linoleum bar and listened to the Bastard Sons of Johnny Cash. A guy in a tattered straw cowboy hat and camouflage pants was whooping it up and ordering around for a group of returning Iraq war veterans. It was a Kerouac moment on the ragged edge of America with its music and its honesty and its violence, and its own sad dance of freedom. At 5:57 a.m., a freight train whistle blew in the Union Pacific rail yards. It was time to get on the road. And I thought about Sal Paradise and Chapter 3 and his Iowa epiphany.
Yeah. woke up as the sky was reddening, and that was the one distinct time in my life, the strangest moment of all, when I didn't know who I was. I was far away from home, haunted and tired with travel, in a cheap hotel room I'd never seen, hearing the hiss of steam outside and the creak of the old wood of the hotel and footsteps upstairs and all the sad sounds. I wasn't scared. I was just somebody else, some stranger, and my whole life was a haunted life, the life of a ghost. I was halfway across America, at the dividing line between the east of my youth and the west of my future. And maybe that's why it happened right there and then, that strange red afternoon.
A reading from Jack Kerouac's On the Road and Charlie Sennett, who retraced Kerouac's journey for the Boston Globe and for a five-part radio series for WBUR, our mother station, is here with us now. Charlie, what did you find? I mean, a lot of people think, oh, driving across country, highway rest stops, soulless. Could you still have the experience Kerouac had?
Well, the people are still there on the road, so you still run into the Americans as you drive across country. But absolutely, there were no interstates back then. These were the local roads. And we had our most interesting experiences by sort of peeling off I-80, the interstate, and getting onto the more local roads like Route 30.
I asked if you could have his experience. And the question, I guess, is could you have your own? You were one of those people inspired when you were a young kid. Now you're not so young anymore.
When I was 16 years old, I did what a lot of teenagers do, which is I read On the Road. I pulled it off my older brother's bookshelf, and the second I put the book down, I felt the call to the road, and I immediately headed south, first to Florida, eventually to New Orleans. And I think that that journey is repeated by a lot of young men and young women. Mostly young men, I would say.
Mm. Is this
and
a guy thing? Is this
I
like
think
a...
it's a bit of a guy thing, but I met a lot of women deeply inspired by Kerouac as well. But I think that it's our version of Huck Finn. You know, the Mississippi River is the highway, and the highway calls. And I think when you go out there and you're young and you're on the road, it's inspiring and you never forget it. And that's why I wanted to, all these years later, return to the road. And I had a great time, and I learned you can hitchhike. And I learned that the people on the road want to talk and share their experiences. And when Kerouac wrote this book, the reviewer said that this book will define a generation that is searching. And I felt that same sense of searching out there on the road today.
Charlie Sennett from the Boston Globe. To see pictures, hear more of his journey, or to see Kerouac's own On the Road map, go to our website, here-now.org. Charlie, thanks.
Thank you.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.